The fact that Tom Mocker is alive today is astonishing. He survived years of addiction and reckless behavior, and then endured years of treatment and recovery programs that were nearly as haphazard and dangerous. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. From a hippie commune to Brooklyn to Georgia to California, stability was rare in Tom Mocker's childhood years. But he was a bright kid, a good athlete, and a good student. When he discovered alcohol, things spun wildly out of control. In his memoir, Halfway, Mocker writes about the boys' homes and halfway houses he was sent to as he tried to reclaim his life, a path that eventually led to the Iowa Writers' Workshop. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tom Mocker's childhood was difficult, but in spite of instability at home, his future looked bright until he discovered alcohol. In his memoir, Halfway, Mocker writes about the boys' homes and the halfway houses he was sent to as he tried to reclaim his life, a path that eventually led him to the Iowa Writers Workshop. He'll be reading at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City tomorrow evening at 7 p.m., and he is with me on the phone today. Hello, Tom.
Hey, Charity. How are you?
Great. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, when you first set out to be a writer, it was your plan to be a fiction writer. What made you decide to dig into your life and tell these stories?
I think well, a couple of things happened. One is I literally remember the day I was waiting for the bus one day after going through the workshop. I was going to work and I was thinking about these stories I was working on and not making much headway with them and what was missing. And the real thing I just kept thinking was, well, I'm writing kind of about this stuff that really happened. And what was intimidating to me was I felt like, why aren't I writing about the real story, actually, is the question that just started coming up to me. And it seemed maybe more interesting than what I was making up. And some places a little harder to believe. And
so when you
so I then, wanted that I yeah, wanted that challenge.
When you decided that you were going to dig into your story and write about what happened to you and the people that you knew who, you know, their experiences were equally or even more difficult than your experience, how did you decide to revisit your experiences? Because I can imagine that plunging back into that life to try to write about it in an accurate way was a little frightening.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm a private person, so definitely for myself, writing about my own experiences, like I just noticed that I was really very guarded with myself and very protective of my privacy. And also, you know, some of the things were sad, they were bleak, and I didn't want to, I was afraid of sort of just hammering away at the sadness or the bleakness of some of these stories, of the people around me or the sort of relationship with me and my father when I was young. It took me a lot of drafting, a lot of different attempts at doing it, but ultimately I just, you know, had to sit down and say, okay, I'm just gonna present this in this draft as straightforward as possible without any excuses or any of my own psychological reads on the situation. And just to present, and then once I could present, I could get a better idea of what was happening, and then use some of those aspects of fictional storytelling to figure out what was, you know, what was going on.
Well, let's go back in time. You make yourself very vulnerable in this book in sharing your story. Let's go back to where things began for you, which largely was on a commune. Tell me about this.
Yeah. Well, I was. I guess my mom and dad met on a commune. They didn't have a long relationship. He was not into the commune after a while, and he bounced. And you know, after he bounced, my mom found out she was pregnant, and she went out there and took her. She was pregnant. She took one of her other sons to San Francisco, where my dad was. And you know, after I was born, was like she went back to the commune, and it was sort of an idyllic place. As I recall it, I was happy there. There was a farm. There was people around all the time. There was a lot of other kids, and we were like, you know, it feels like a memory, feral children just kind of wandering around this 400-acre spread, getting into barns and ponds and creeks and the woods. And it was in an old Shaker village, so there's these tall buildings with these cellars and lots of places to hide and play and get lost.
Mentioned that you were with one of your older half-brothers. We need to talk a little bit about your mom, because at the point at which she discovered she was pregnant with you, she was in a really difficult circumstance. She had two older boys. Her marriage had failed. And when her husband left, he took one of the boys, right?
Yeah, they got divvied up. The guy, I would say guru or the leader of the movement they were part of, divvied up my two older brothers, half brothers, and one went with their father and one stayed with her.
So this wasn't a legal settlement. This was the leader of this commune making a decision.
From what I understand, I'm not sure if there was some legal documentation or not. I've never I can't imagine. I think it was just that was the way it went down. And, equally unsatisfying for everybody involved, probably.
Right. And your mom was then very much, in spite of the fact that she lived on a commune, I mean, she was very much alone in the world. She didn't have family.
Yeah, that's correct. And hi, Mom, by the way, if you're listening. She didn't have any immediate family, or, you know, like you would say, aunts and uncles in the picture, anything like that. And she was just, you know, trying to find some stability, basically. Had these two kids and another on the way.
You write about your time after your mom returned to the commune, after having really no other place to go with you and your older brother, Lee. You write about looking at pictures of you and Lee from that time. And of course, you were pretty young, so your memories may be a little bit fuzzy. But looking at those pictures, you see a reality that did not extend to your later relationships with your brother, Lee. But you seem to be inseparable during that time.
Yeah, we're very much in love. In those years, yeah, there's like this, we're always together. It's like attached at the hip, yeah. We're just very proud. Like, I could just see that he's proud of his younger brother at that age. And, yeah.
So, just kind of your mom does get remarried, and you end up moving to Brooklyn. Tell me about life in Brooklyn.
Brooklyn was, we're going from this very idyllic world to, you know, like now we've got like dirty snow, there's sirens all the time, there's, you know, my mom's telling me there's, the cars are backfiring, they're probably gunshots, you know. You leave tricycle outside on the street for to run inside and use the bathroom, and you come out and it's gone. We had, you know, we were stuck out like sore thumbs, and we go to school, there's fights at school. And at the same time, we're, me and Lee, I think, are starting to figure out that we don't have the same family exactly. We don't have the same father, and that starts to matter a little bit, because I think I meet my father, or it's the first memory I have of meeting my father is around then, and his family, and it's weird to me. It really stands out that Lee doesn't come with me when I go to meet my, you know, my father.
Right, that doesn't make sense to you, because you've always been together.
Yeah, it's like the first heartbreaking moment for me in that in the relationship with Lee. You know?
But there is a little aspect of an almost fairy tale idea there when your grandfather comes to pick you up. This grandfather that you've never met comes to pick you up and whisk you away and really spoil you for a day.
Yeah. It's not something. I mean, you know, we're in Brooklyn, and I think, you know, we spent some time in Manhattan, but it was like the Lower East Side, which is pretty rough at that time. And, you know, so now we're, you know, I'm all of a sudden going from going to a penthouse uptown, you know, in FAO Schwartz. And I think at one point, maybe a Broadway show or something like that. So really kind of, it's like two different, you know, this whole other different world.
And your grandfather was seeking a relationship with you, but that is, as you just mentioned, that's the first time you actually met your biological father. What do you remember about that meeting?
I thought he was cool, you know. I think I described him in the book as having like some aviators on and like sipping a martini and like telling a joke or something, you know. He's got a cigarette in his hand, and it's a party. They're having a party, you know. And I don't know, you know, what kind of thing was prearranged about this party. You know, maybe they were there to see me. I don't know. You know, maybe they were just having a party and my grandfather was drunk and was like, let's go get the boy. You know, I really don't know what the context of it was. But I felt like maybe I felt my father was disappointed in me when I first met him. At that time,
he just didn't seem to have much interest at all.
Yeah, he was, it seemed like he was super cool, you know, like just too cool for it all. And that was my take on it. Now that, you know, it's like anything else when you're remembering something, it's your reality, your take on it.
Well, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guest today is Tom Mocker. He's just published his first book. It's a memoir. It's called Halfway. And it tells the story of his childhood, but also the story of his descent into addiction and the treatment programs that he went to as he tried to reclaim his life. And we will talk more in just a moment. He'll be reading at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with author Tom Mocker. He's just published his first book. It's a memoir called Halfway, telling the story of his childhood, his battles with addiction, and the halfway house that he spent a great deal of time with as he tried to reclaim his life. And Tom, just before the break, we were talking about your childhood, about that first time you met your father. After meeting your dad, meeting your grandfather, there was an effort, at least on the part of your grandfather, to develop a relationship with you. And he tried to facilitate a relationship between you and your dad. But it was it was all difficult as best, even with your grandfather's good intentions. I mean, he was an alcoholic. Your father was an alcoholic. I mean, this was a really difficult situation for you as a child who just wanted somebody to love you.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know if either one of them were alcoholics. They definitely were hard drinkers in that time, though. But, yeah, it was, you know, my grandfather was very interested and keen on us having a relationship. And, you know, I think pushing my father to stay in my life, and my grandfather was, he would call regularly and write letters and stuff like that. He was quite active at that time, as far as I can tell. I could say that he's the only grandparent I knew, because I didn't know, you know, my mom's parents were both long dead, and so he was good for me. Yeah,
right. Your stepdad and mom decided that moving to Georgia would be a good idea. What was life like for you in Georgia?
We moved there. We stayed for the first 6 months with my stepdad's sister and her family. And she had two kids, one about my age and one a little younger. And then we moved to across town near Emory, and I think my stepdad was trying to start a business. My mom was in night school and working, and me and Lee, my brother, were just, again, I feel like feral children is a good description. There was a railroad tracks across the street, and we would just go throw rocks at the railroad car, at the train, and put stuff on the tracks, and really kind of get into trouble, you know. We'd walk to school and get about halfway there, and Lee would be like, you know what, I'm going to skip school. And he would just turn around and go home. And we were like, I don't know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, something like that. Started getting into baseball and playing sports and just really messing around in the woods a lot.
You did find a home in athletics. That was something that you... you had some talent, you really enjoyed, but you also were a good student. I mean, your future looked really bright in many ways.
Yeah, I got some good test scores, and I did well in school. And I think, you know, a lot of times they were throwing around the words like promise and potential, or maybe they weren't using those words. That's what I think of now, you know, like, oh, this kid's got a lot of potential. And I could remember one of my teachers being very keen on me being an engineer and building bridges and stuff like that. She used to talk to me about, it seemed like that's what I was going to do, go to college, maybe, you know, a good college and be a good student.
And yeah. You and Lee, as close as you had been, as close as you were when you moved to Georgia, really went in different directions. What happened with your relationship with your brother?
It's a very tough question. I mean, that's another book, you know. It seemed like things tended to come easy for me, and I don't with school and with sports, I think, and I don't think they came as easy for Lee. And I think we started to get into a very rivalry-based thing, where it was, you know, we were rivals about good stuff and bad stuff, you know, whose father was more absent, that kind of thing, and holding over. You know, he had a very absent father as well, and we would hold over whatever infrequent contact we got.
Right.
You know, like, oh, my God, I got a letter today, and the first thing I'm going to do is go brag to my brother about it, you know.
And there came a point with that contact with your dad where Lee kind of got some ammunition He learned that your father was gay before you learned that your father was gay.
Yeah. Yeah. And my father, you know, wasn't ready to tell me. And he felt compelled that because he knew that my other brothers had found out that their father had sat them down and felt compelled to share with them that information. Now my father had to act before they started giving me a hard time about it, just so I would be ready for it when they did give me a hard time about it.
How did you feel about it when you learned?
I felt two things. I mean, one is I felt relieved in some ways because I felt like it explained his absence. I felt like his absence now was more about his lifestyle for whatever reason than for
lack of interest in you, right?
Yeah, ambivalence towards me. And I also felt worried. I mean, this is like what I knew of he lived in San Francisco, and what I knew about things then was that AIDS was just this ravaging force, you know, that was destroying whole neighborhoods and just killing everybody. And I worried about him.
You were hopeful, too, that after finding out his secret that he hadn't told you, that maybe that would be the thing that removed the barrier between you and actually gave you an opportunity to be close, didn't you?
Absolutely, yeah. I thought, okay, now that this is out of the way and everything is in the open, we're going to be cool now. We're going to be, you know, father and son. Yeah.
So
I was very excited.
Right. So here you are in Georgia. Things are going pretty well for you in school. You're not getting along with your brother, but it sounds like you were really a part of the community. You had friends. And this is the point at which you discover alcohol. Tell me what happened.
The night I remember really setting out to get drunk in earnest for the first time, we sat around a kitchen table drinking chilled vodka, and you know, I really felt like everything I was saying was funny all of a sudden. You know, my jokes were always hitting, and we went and, you know, we messed around in the woods, and you know, there's like a dulling of pain, and I felt like this was the thing that I had been missing my whole life. You know, it wasn't that I was missing a relationship with my father or whatever else, whatever other hole we feel inside ourselves. I felt like this thing absolutely filled it, and I was complete, and this is what I was going to do now. It wasn't going to be, you know, like school wasn't so important, even baseball, athletics weren't so important. This was it. I was going to be, this is what I was going to do with my life.
I'm talking to Tom Mocker. His first book has just been published. It's called Halfway. It's a memoir of his younger years. And so, Tom, I mean, that's a story that's familiar to a lot of people who discover the joys, the numbing effect of alcohol in their teen years. And when that happened, when you felt that release, when you felt, you know, the freedom that you felt like alcohol could give you, what happened in the rest of your life?
I think things fell to the side a bit. This became the important thing, and you know, as you said, it's familiar to a lot of people. There's something that happens where everything else just sort of fades away. And everything goes into this one thing that you want to, you know, you want to do. And it becomes the only thing that matters.
You, your mom tried to pull things back from the brink. You ended up going to a boarding school until you got kicked out of boarding school. Your family moved to California, and things just kind of careened out of control. I want to fast forward to a moment where your brother Lee had gone to live with his dad for a while, so you hadn't seen him in a while, and he comes to visit with a girlfriend, and you've been on a major bender, and you wind up behind the wheel of a car. Tell me what happened.
Yeah. I mean, basically it was wasn't paying attention, and ultimately what happened is just a head-on collision, and the complete front of the car just got just destroyed. And it was a thing where in California, when it first rains, because it doesn't rain for 7 or 8 months, that first day of rain, all the oil built up from the road makes braking a little bit more difficult. And I'm completely messed up. My reaction time is off, and the car didn't stop, and I just ran head on into this woman and her car, and ended up getting a ultimatum, that either I had to.
And miraculously, you were not. No one was horribly injured in this accident, which could have been a fatal accident.
Absolutely, yeah. We were all okay as far as things go, yeah. No one died or ended up in the hospital.
Right. So this was the breaking point for your mom.
That was it. She's like, enough's enough, you're not gonna harm your brother, yourself, or anyone else. And she was going to wash her hands of me at that moment.
So this is the point at which you got sent to a boys' home, a rural boys' home for kids in a situation just like you. What, you were 17 years old at this point?
I had just turned 17, that's mm-hmm. correct.
So tell me about the boys' home. What was that like?
Well, it was a bunch of kids. I guess the youngest was probably about 13, and then the oldest was 24, and he was a major outlier. Most of us were like 13 to 19, and then there was like a 24-year-old guy, weirdly enough. And we lived in these cabins on a ranch in the Rockies, and it was very cold, and it's the first time I had heard this expression of institutionally thin blankets before.
I'm having a hard time hearing you, Tom. Are we losing?
Oh.
Okay, there we go. So you'd heard of thin blankets, institutionally thin blankets before, but you were cold.
Yeah, so we had like one little thin blanket and a sheet, and we're in these old cabins. I don't know how old they were, 100 years old Lincoln log cabins, single pane glass, and the wind is just whipping down off these mountains. It was cold and it was bleak, and everybody was talking about being sober and, how happy and pink clouding and how happy they were to be sober, and how happy they were to be there. And I just was like, get me out of here. I do not want to be here at all. I want to get back to high school. I want to be a normal kid, really.
Did you understand the serious problem that you had at that point?
I understood that I couldn't drink safely. I thought there was a way around it. I was looking for a loophole. Maybe I could just do other things. Maybe I could just smoke pot. I don't know, I thought I could beat it, really. And I thought I could be different.
The boys and men that you were there with, they all had, I guess, similar experiences, similar backgrounds. And, obviously there had to be a major breaking point for someone to wind up at this home. What were your relationships with them like? I mean, you were all encouraged to do a lot of sharing to bare your hearts to each other.
Yeah, we bonded really quickly, you know. It's like you start talking to somebody and you start to see all these similarities, whatever they are. You know, and even if you can't identify your feelings around those similarities, you understand the sort of, it's like, oh wow, you're really, you feel like family to me right away. I felt very comfortable around a lot of them, and grew very close. And of course, you know, at that age, I thought, well, we're always going to be close.
The counselors working with you were telling you some really tough things about, you know, the idea that, well, you will drink again. Not everybody here is going to live. That, you know, they were looking into the future and seeing some pretty bleak things for you.
Right.
And right. I can imagine, I mean, from the perspective of professionals who work in that field, it's got to be hard, because while they meet with some success, they also see a lot of failures.
Right. Right. Yeah. They're saying, you know, I mean, the classic thing is like, stand up, look to your left, look to your right, you know, one out of three of you is going to be alive in 5 years or something like that. Or, you know, you take a room of 20 people and say, three, y'all stand up. That's who's going to be, you know, sober in 3 years or whatever it is.
We're going to take another short break. We'll be back. We'll talk more about that boys' home. We'll talk about the halfway house you went to after that. My guest is Tom Mocker. He has just published his memoir. It's called Halfway. He'll be reading at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. He is a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop. And we'll continue in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, my guest is Tom Mocker. He's just published his first book. It's a memoir called Halfway. It's about his childhood and his teen years as an addict, and then getting sent to a boys' home in the wilderness, and later on to a halfway house. And just before the break, we were talking about that boys' home experience. And when you were there, Tom, did you have an idea how long you were supposed to be there?
Well, no, I thought, you know, I mean, I was a junior in high school, and I think I'd stopped going to high school maybe that October or something. And I thought, well, I'll be back, and baseball season starts the last week of January or whatever, and I'll be back and back in regular life at the end of January, and late January at the latest. You know, I thought this is just a quick little break from it all. Yeah.
How long were you there?
I was there a few months, and I mean, I went to a halfway house, and it was not what I thought it was going to be as far as going back to regular high school life.
The culmination of your time at the boys' home was a thing that they called Trip, where you and a group of boys would go out into the wilderness. Do you know what the idea was behind Trip? What were they hoping that you'd accomplish out there?
Faith, or feeling like you can accomplish something, get through something, go without and overcome. I don't know. Yeah. Stuff like that.
Your trip was not a smooth journey. Tell me what happened on that trip. The setup in and of itself is enough to curl your hair, I think, thinking about it. This was a winter trip. You were supposed to be doing a lot of cross-country skiing, and you went out with one social worker and one wilderness guide. How many guys were part of this trip?
There were seven of us, and then the wilderness guide and the social worker. And I believe the social worker had never been on a trip before and was pretty out of shape, whereas we'd been, I mean, from the minute we got to that ranch, they were getting us ready to do this thing in a way, you know, we were doing all the things you do to get ready, drying meats and fruit and skiing and working all the time. So we were, they were getting us in shape, and the social worker was not in shape at all. Clearly had not been on a pair of skis in a long time.
And she was, she was a she, sending a woman out there with seven guys who are in treatment and a male wilderness guide. That seems like an unusual decision to make. And that was the first time that that had ever been done, right?
That's right, yeah.
And the last time, spoiler alert.
Last time.
So
yeah.
what happened when you were out there?
We got behind schedule, and we had brought along, we had like, you know, our lunch stops, and then we had a bunch of, you know, food, dinner and breakfast. And after about like 10 days being out there, we were supposed to resupply, and we just got terribly behind schedule. And, you know, we were supposed to go like 10, 15 miles in a day. We would go 6 or 8. And we were just like not reaching our goals. And, you know, people started to meet out there, I think, their foodstuffs, you know, burning all these calories. Tempers are going bad. None of us are smoking, you know. None of us are doing any of the stuff. You know, no nicotine, obviously no alcohol or drugs. And the food is getting less and less.
And
we ended up,
Go ahead.
I was going to say, we ended up, we were supposed to climb this mountain one day, and we were just starting to feel very mutinous as a group, and we thought that the seven of us boys thought that if we dilly-dallied up the trail, they wouldn't make us actually climb this mountain, and in fact, that they did keep making us climb the mountain. It became very apparent that we weren't going to make it to the top. Even then, they kept after us, and we had not brought any food. We had not brought any winter clothes because it was unseasonably warm. And we ended up at the top of the mountain after sunset, and the temperature fell, and we couldn't go back down the mountain the way we went because it was too icy now. And we just kind of had to find a way down the backside of the mountain. And yes, became very, very mutinous.
Right. And you were out there pretty much all night finding that way back, right?
Yeah, we were out there all night. I mean, I can't remember what time exactly we got back to camp, but it was, you know, it was probably mid-morning the next day. And, you know,
so
I mean, I'll be...
Yeah, it was incredibly dangerous. It seems also like an incredibly dangerous situation for the woman who was with you, although the worst did not happen when you were out there. You did return safely. What do you think you took away from that experience? What do you think any of you guys took away from that experience?
I didn't feel very, very trusting. I mean, I knew a lot of people who went on that trip who came back feeling like they were on cloud nine, and I felt very skeptical of the whole thing. And I also felt like, you know, maybe in retrospect, I can see that I was a little bit more thug-minded maybe than I thought I was at the time. And, you know, the ultimate result of that sort of mindset is that I got sent to an adult facility from there after that trip.
And I'd love for you to read us just the first page from when you arrive at this halfway house to introduce us to it a little bit. You get sent to a halfway house in Louisiana.
Yeah. Okay, so... The house was on West Road, which was the kind of street in a part of town you'll almost never go. Locals called it Crack Row, and they had reason. Now, of course, our country's drug of choice has changed, as has the neighborhood where it's bought and sold. But back then, rock was everywhere, and on West Road, you could hear the dope man, Tree, and his bass long before his lowrider made our block. Homes here were small, old, manufactured, half-dropped on cinder blocks or bricks. They had unfinished stoops, tinfoil-blocked windows, and plywood exteriors, or missing shingles and doors and doorknobs. I never could tell which were inhabited and which merely used. West Road had so many crack houses that when police came and shut one place down, the next day everyone went next door. Bass heads littered the area. We'd see them pedal their bicycles past the property, return a few hours later on foot. Like the ranch, it was the middle of nowhere, halfway between Baton Rouge and New Orleans, in a truck stop town of swamp and cypress. And maybe if you drove past the outlet mall and chemical plants to the levee or into the Maurepas boondocks and a meet, you'd find the beautiful and exquisite, a painted owl, egret, or alligator. Yet the house was close in, and all we saw were the broke down, desperate, and washed out. They'd drift by each day getting skinnier and skinnier until they were only a pile of loose clothes jerking up the road, eyes sunk in their skulls, knuckles, knees, and elbows pushing up through their scabbed skin.
That's Tom Mocker reading from his memoir, Halfway. And you mentioned this was an adult facility for the most part. So you were there. You were 17 years old. You're there with some people in their 60s. A lot of people
That's right.
who've had a lot of different life experiences. Everybody struggling with addiction. And I'm struck by, as powerful as your relationships became with some of the people who were there to help you, by how marginalized those people are as well. I mean, the whole thing feels like such an incredibly precarious and dangerous situation, where not only are there people who can kind of barely hold their lives together trying to help each other, but here you are plunked in the middle of this neighborhood where temptation is around every corner. You also tried to go to high school in this community. What was that like to try to go from the halfway house to high school every day?
I mean, it was hilarious because we're, you know, like there's these, it's a regular high school, just like a small town high school. And we're just like these guys from this sort of halfway house. I mean, we're notorious already the minute we walk in the door. And, you know, everybody's doing their regular high school thing. And we're going back and like detailing the parking lot at the property with a toothbrush. We're like, you'll see us like picking trash out of the gullies on the side of the road. And we're always like around town in this formation where it's like 15 or 20 of us ages, you know, like in, as high as, I think the oldest guy I saw was 73 and the youngest was 15. And it's just, it was hilarious going to school. Yeah.
Well, and the other kids knew that you lived in the halfway house. So, I mean, that must've made it incredibly hard to connect with any other students.
Yeah, they were skeptical of us or I mean, maybe like a distant kind of an admiration from the kids. Like I can see in retrospect, guys who I know their stories who later ended up getting into some trouble themselves would kind of maybe give you a knowing look or something like that. Obviously, we were bad boys and, you know, a few of us got a lot of female attention at that school. Which was completely off limits for us in the house, but it definitely was part of it. Teachers let us, you know, I mean, I don't think the teachers knew what to do. I can remember just going and I would just literally put my head down a first period, go to sleep, and I would sleepwalk between classes, and just that's how I went about my day at school, sleepwalking and smoking cigarettes in the bathroom.
You, in writing about this, you share the stories of a lot of the other men and boys that were also part of this world. What you share the story of your life in the halfway house, and that's kind of where you end. Now, clearly, a lot of things have happened in your life since then. You managed to go to college. You have relationships with your family members. You went to graduate school at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. You seem to have made it through all of this. Do you feel like that time at the halfway house gave you tools to fight your addiction?
Yeah, I do.
And what? How did it help?
I feel like it taught me to be skeptical of my own thinking, for one thing, and I think that's probably one of the most important things, is that if I have an idea that seems really good to me, it may be not that great of an idea, and I need to probably run it by somebody else and sort of look at maybe some alternative options or what's really going on in my mind. What am I really after? What am I really looking for? And that was hammered into us 100% of the time we were there.
So many of the guys that you were there with didn't make it. Why do you think you did?
I found something that I wanted to do, and I think that I wanted to tell stories, and I definitely wanted to tell some of the stories about us, the guys that were in that house, and what happened to us. And I knew I couldn't do that if I was drinking and drugging. And that kept me going a lot. I also have been very lucky. I mean, I got really lucky with my mom telling me I had to leave. I'm very fortunate to have people in my life who did care about me enough to not always give me what I wanted or think beyond immediate gratification. I've been very, very, very blessed.
You write about the people that you were there with affection and respect. You take us inside this world that so many of us is so foreign to so many of us. And it's terrifying, just from my personal perspective. What do you want us to take away from this visit to this other world?
I think that things are, I don't know. I mean, I guess that this is a problem, alcoholism, and I fit any kind of drug addiction into this umbrella as well. It's like, it's a problem that is very real, and it needs to be taken seriously. And a lot of times when our loved ones are going through trying to get sober, we want to listen to them. We want to give them what they want. But what they want is to be messed up and to stay messed up. And I think the way that I felt like I could talk about that was talking about how messed up we were and what ended up happening to us. A little bit.
How do you think revisiting all of this changed you?
Different parts of the book are changed in different ways. I mean, I definitely felt different writing about my childhood, that definitely opened up some new lines of thought on that. I also, as I was writing the book, when I signed the contract, when I first started writing it, I didn't really want to write that much about the house. I wanted to write about the stories outside the house and stuff. And I felt like it gave me something. I feel proud of it. I have some pride about.
Well, Tom, thank you so much. The book is Halfway, a memoir. Tom Mocker is the author. This is Talk of Iowa.